Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross, once again here to entertain and inform and do whatever we can to just kill an hour. And Rob Ross, how's everything going in the Big Apple?
Well, you know, it's that time of season when everybody's going around saying Merry Christmas and so on and so forth. And all I have to say is any fool that goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled in his own Christmas pudding and have a stake of holly driven through his heart. I bid you good day, sir. Humbug.
So uplifting, so uplifting. And we've got a ton to talk about, plenty to go over. And I hate to start out on a down note, but I don't see how we could avoid it, because this week not only did we lose a giant in the singing and songwriting world, but we also lost a guy who happens to be a friend of yours. Tell us a little bit about your experience with Pat Denizio, the Smithereens.
Well, let me just start by saying, is it not enough that we lost Grant Hart a couple of short months ago,
yeah,
and then a few weeks ago, Tommy Keane? This one is still hard to process and digest. It goes back to when I was a kid, actually, because the first time I ever saw and heard the Smithereens was on the old Uncle Floyd show,
mm-hmm,
which was, if people don't know, it was called a kids show. But it was very adult and risque humor. It was almost vaudevillian. It was brilliant. You know, puppets, skits, shtick, a lot of in-jokes that once you were a regular viewer of the show, you understood what those in-jokes really meant. But the thing about Uncle Floyd was that he always had either punk/new wave bands on, or more importantly, local punk/new wave bands. And that was critical at that time. He gave exposure to a lot of people. And the Smithereens were a Jersey-based band. And they came on, I believe it was the summer of 1980. They came on the show, and they did a song called Girls of Bad Town.
Everybody's talking, but they don't know nothing. They've got some secrets that they're willing to share. Everybody wants a bigger piece of your action. I want to tell them that I don't really care. Girls!
And I just thought, this is great, and it's really catchy. And on one of my first forays into Manhattan, you know, as a teenager, it was that verboten place where, you know, freaks, faggots, junkies, general weirdos and degenerates hung out.
Yep.
So obviously my kind of people were there.
Exactly.
And I went to a store called Village Oldies, and I picked this single up amongst other local 45s that just looked good. Things that to this day are probably now considered, you know, forgotten classics. But a couple of years later, lo and behold, I happened to see an ad in the Aquarian, and it was for the new EP from the Smithereens called Beauty and Sadness, which I immediately went out and bought because I, of course, had that one single. So this was their second release, and I fell instantly in love with it. And if you've never heard Beauty and Sadness, it's the only song I can think of that takes the drum pattern of Tomorrow Never Knows and does something with it that's worthwhile. Because there are so many songs in that frame, but nothing is as good as this one song by the Smithereens. It has always been and will forever be my favorite song by them. And just a very few short months later, we were on the bill with the Smithereens at this club in Jersey. I don't remember where. I think it was in Bloomfield. I don't remember. It was in the beginning days of 2 Minutes Hate, and we all were on the same bill. And I was absolutely thrilled because I thought of the Smithereens as rock stars at that point, you know?
Right, sure.
I still hadn't, you know, gotten out of that mindset of hey, we're all just locals. You know, they had an EP out. We were trying to save money to record our first cassette EP. But they were great. Not just as a band, they were great as people. Pat couldn't have been nicer, kinder, more embracing. When we realized that we all had the same musical tastes in common, he was very, very accommodating to us. He wanted to get to know us better. And it formed a friendship that lasted 30 plus years. So, of course, for me, to know that he's gone suddenly, you know, he'd been in declining health. He hadn't looked healthy in a very long time, I will say that. But his talent never diminished. His love of music, his genuineness had never changed. And like I said, I'm kind of doing this on autopilot because I still can't process the fact that he's gone. And one of the biggest thrills I ever had was when people would say, you know who you guys sound like? And now we're talking about in the punchline period. You guys remind me of a cross between REM and the Smithereens. And I would always say, well, I think we probably sound more like the Smithereens because we're all from the same area. And that was a bigger compliment to me than the REM thing.
Yeah.
The Smithereens were so, they were so ours and so much a part of me and the people I knew and my own little social set. And I, you know, I'm heartbroken. I, that's the only thing I can say without sounding cloying about it. It's just I'm having a hard time with this.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. And again, just from the musical standpoint of being a fan, it's that same kind of toughness that we've had to deal with so many times over the last couple of years. And unfortunately, that just hasn't let up. What also hasn't let up, as I pull off a really terrible segue, is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame once again kicking us in the teeth. Because, you know, the reason that it's there is for people to argue about and bitch about. I get that. I understand that you can't have a Hall of Fame without having some kind of arguments about who gets in and who doesn't. But, I mean, when there are so many fantastic, really accomplished bands who are not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and some of whom rarely even get nominated, and yet Bon Jovi gets in. I mean, come on. Why don't they just walk up to all of us and slap us in the face?
Well, look at the fact that the Zombies were nominated. The Zombies have one of the most influential albums of all time.
Ever, right.
Odyssey and Oracle is ranked up there, number two, maybe number three, if you really want to stretch it, with Pet Sounds and, ugh, Sgt. Pepper. But, you know, it's ranked up there as either number two or number three. That's no small achievement for a start.
Right.
That album is a flawless document. But aside from that album, you know, what else was in the Zombies canon? She's Not There. Tell Her No. Imagine the Swan. You know, Girl Help Me. All these incredible songs. And a singer like nobody else, like Colin Blunstone, who has a voice that's comparable with those of the Angels. I mean, he's just such a magnificent, pure singer. They nominate them, but don't put them in, but you give the nod to Bon Jovi. Yeah. I've got nothing against the Cars, but the history of the Zombies is a lot longer and a lot greater than that of the Cars.
Right, well, not to mention there was that guy Rod Argent, who I think did a couple of other things.
That's what I was about to say, you know, the Zombies got Argent, you know?
Yep.
And Colin Blunstone's solo career. And, you know, Paul Atkinson was, God rest his soul, was a fantastic A&R man. And Chris White was a magnificent producer. The Cars? I mean, I'm sorry. Like I said, I don't have it.
Right.
I don't have it. It's just, it's irritating.
Well,
but
now
you pointed out, though, I want to point out what you said about fantastic and talented bands. That seems to get overlooked. That really does, because if that was the case, the Monkees would be in there.
Yep.
And that's an argument that every one of us can and are making. Or, as much as it pains me after his performance recently, Todd Rundgren's not in there yet.
Right.
The New York Dolls.
Yeah.
They were a fantastic band, but their influence is just absolutely, you can't put a price on that.
Right, not to mention the fact that, you know, David Johansen also had several different careers and continues in some degree to have several different careers.
Thunders. Possibly, just on the back of one album with the Heartbreakers and some very questionable solo albums, is one of the most influential musicians of any generation.
In among that, though, I mean, there is something that they did right, because Dire Straits deserves the accolades. They deserve to get in. And I was having this conversation, and any time you put yourself out there again, there are always going to be people who are going to say, what about this guy? And what I said on the air this week was, I don't know that I've ever heard a guitar player better than Mark Knopfler. Now, I've heard his peers, and certainly comparing him to a lot of the regular rock and roll guitarists, the Pages, Becks, and Claptons, doesn't make a lot of sense because he doesn't play the same style that they do. But in terms of being a technically incredibly efficient and beautiful guitar player, Mark Knopfler's outstanding.
The thing about Knopfler's playing is that it's a very understated and very fluid style.
Right.
That's the one thing, I mean, if you notice, there's no flash. He doesn't get up and do histrionics. He doesn't go overboard with the solos. His solos are completely economical.
Right.
But They're always tasteful, intricate, and they always fit the song. And that's the most important thing. Jimmy Page is, without a doubt, probably the greatest rock guitarist around, but he is the master of guitar masturbation. I'm sorry.
Yes, he is.
He's the one who really showed Eddie Van Halen how to jerk off a guitar neck, because the two of them, you know, I think they're both amazing, but God, can you just stop it?
There is a series of videos that anybody who is a fan of guitar players should really go check out. It's a series of YouTube videos called the Shreds series. And what this guy did, and he must be an amazing player himself, because what he was able to do is he took footage of guys like Eddie Van Halen and all of these, you know, top guitar players. I think Satriani's got one too. And overdubbed him playing while the camera is on these guitar players, but he's playing lousy. So it fits, though. The great thing about it, once you see him, you'll understand what I mean. It fits what you see on the screen, and it just takes these guys down a peg and makes them look like the least accomplished hacks you've ever heard in your life. They're fantastic.
I mean, is there anything really joyful about listening to an Eddie Van Halen guitar solo? Say for a couple of ones that fit those particular songs, like Ain't Talking About Love or Jamie's Crying, you know, things like that. You know, I would much rather have a guitar solo stay in my head forever, like 90% of the ones that George Harrison did.
Harrison, by
no means, was a great guitar player.
Right.
Carney was a better guitar player, hence Taxman. But what Harrison did always fit the songs, and they were always tasteful and memorable.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, I'm the guy who worships Jeff Beck, but Jeff Beck plays in a completely different style, because his is not a rock style per se. His is infused with his absolute love/worship of soul music, particularly that of Stax and Steve Cropper. And he also plays with jazz influences. So he doesn't stand it. Well, let's face it. Beck is a solo artist unto himself. He's also a little bit, you know.
Right.
That's the word I'm looking for. He's a little eccentric, shall we say?
Mm-hmm.
But he plays at least with a greater sense of tastefulness. He knows the when and where to stop when he's being, quote, flashy.
Right. But going back to Harrison, because I was thinking him while you were leading up to that, and I'm glad that's where you ended up with George, because you look at, for example, All My Lovin', where George just listens to the song and figures, oh, it needs Chet Atkins in it. And then makes this incredible Chet Atkins-style guitar solo that, again, isn't flashy, and it's kind of countrified, which is something the Beatles didn't do much at that point, and yet, in that song, it's perfect.
You mean Stig O'Hara on Hold My Hand?
Yeah, that's right. Good old Stig. But yeah, that's, I don't know, with Knopfler's stuff, the other thing that always stunned me about him is that I don't think he has ever used a flat pick in his life. Almost everything that he does is finger picked, and he doesn't even use the little finger picks, the ones that stick onto the end of your fingers. That's just all his calloused, gnarly old fingers doing that.
I think you're right. I don't recall ever seeing a pick on the edge of his finger, much like Lindsey Buckingham.
Right.
Who was just, we talked about him, what, a week, 2 weeks ago, and no matter how you slice it, that guy is just a phenomenal player.
Yeah.
Just unreal.
Congratulations, I guess, to everybody. And Nina Simone is the other one that's raising a lot of eyebrows this week in terms of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions. You know, with them going into a more jazz realm or a more hip-hop realm or whatever, I'm fine with all of that. I mean, it all fits under the umbrella, I think.
You know, I would pick somebody like Nina Simone because she was part of that whole rhythm and blues and jazz thing, which had the influence of building the foundation of what became rock and roll.
Right.
I'm fine with that. I do have the problem with rap and hip hop, but I also have the problem with somebody like Madonna. She's not rock and roll.
Right.
There's nothing rock and roll about her. I'm sorry. She may have hung out in the punk clubs, but her music is the most saccharine, especially the early things that made her Madonna and made her famous. They're all saccharine sweet dance pop and nothing particularly There's nothing rock and roll about it. I'm sorry. You know, I just as I would sooner put Climax Blues Band or Player in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or Ambrosia. You know, because that's easy listening yacht rock.
You know? Ladies and gentlemen, Sessions presents the Atlanta Rhythm Section.
They're so into you. Well, I bet you everybody at Popdos though would agree with us on that front as far as you know, nominating all the yacht rockers. But hell, I would take any one of them over a Madonna or Public Enemy or even my own homies, you know, Wu-Tang, because they're from Shaolin and they represent just like me. But they're not rock. I'm sorry. There's a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Since there's always this hip hop Hall of Fame bullshit or R&B Hall of Fame bullshit, okay, then. Keep them separated.
Build one.
Is there still, or are we going to go into the whole political realm of, well, it's racist if we don't bring everybody into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Do I need to remind people who invented rock and roll?
Yeah, right. I'm pretty sure the very first person ever inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was Chuck Berry.
My guess would be you're correct.
So, that said, yeah, well, it's a good thing the thing is in Cleveland, so none of us have to look at it accidentally. But
the one in New York City was closed, the Annex.
Yeah, yeah.
Charged $25 admission to a Soho storefront. I'm happy to say it's now a Scholastic Books store. Remember Scholastic when we were kids?
Oh, sure.
The Reader Book Club? That's who took over that spot. Something of merit. Hooray, because there's no way in hell I would have ever even conceived of paying $25 to see Kurt Cobain's filthy sweater.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really want to go pay to see the shit owned by a nihilistic junkie. Thank you.
Yeah, no thanks. And it's, you know, that brings up something that happened last night, and I've only seen the first performance that they did, but I want to say, was it... one of the writers on Popdos this morning on Facebook made mention of the Foo Fighters and said, well, it's official now, the Foo Fighters suck. And I know it was in reference to the SNL performance, but I only saw the first one.
The first song sucked.
Yeah, it was terrible.
It was a shitty song. The second one, though, that was the shocker. And I have to admit, I was very, very impressed and amused by it. What it was it started off with Grohl singing Everlong by himself up front of the mic.
Okay.
You know, the band all in the dark. And then all of a sudden it kicked in with a full version with the girl singers that they've employed behind them on last night's appearance doing, was it Baby Please Come Home for Christmas?
Okay, yeah, uh-huh.
Segueing into, of all things, the Charlie Brown theme.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, you're going to get full fucking marks, especially with the fact that most of them were wearing ugly Christmas sweaters.
Yep.
So if you really have to be that over-analytical with the Foo Fighters, I'm sorry, I think you're missing it, because I don't think even the Dave Grohl takes it that seriously.
I agree. I think that's right, and I think, you know, while you were talking, I was thinking of Patrick Stewart, because all of the goofy shit that they get Patrick Stewart to do on camera, and people think, this guy's a Shakespearean actor, and he was Jean-Luc Picard, and why is he doing all this crazy, goofy shit and making fun of himself? And it's because he doesn't take himself that seriously. That's why.
I got five words. Family Guy, American Dad, Ted.
Done.
That's right. I mean, come on, people. You know, by the way, Foo Fighters is probably the stupidest named band of all time. Right there, you can't take anything too seriously.
Right.
Is it because people are clinging to the image of Grohl behind the drums when he was in Nirvana?
Probably.
Because if that's the case, grow up.
Exactly. Yeah, things do change. And sometimes they change for the better.
I mean, I hated Nirvana. That's no secret. I hated grunge. I hated the early 90s. I shed no tears over Kurt Cobain. I've shed no tears over any of those people. The point is that Dave Grohl, upon the obvious ending of Nirvana, dusted himself off, said, I'm a musician. First he played with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, thought about taking that job permanently when it was offered to him, right?
Right.
And decides, you know what, I'm going to do something not expected. I'm going to go play guitar and sing instead. He starts this band, and he puts together that first album, I think, is absolute it's fantastic. It really is. And we're talking to somebody who has enormous prejudices against anything that has to do with Nirvana. But I heard This Is a Call and thought, fucking remarkable. One of the best singles of 1995. Foo Fighters have obviously surpassed Nirvana. I'm sorry to burst your bubble, people, but they've surpassed Nirvana by streets and miles in terms of success, sales, obviously longevity, and just the fact that this is a band that has grown and changed over the 20 years now that they've been around as a band, quote-unquote as a band. What the fuck else do you want? I mean, is this going back to something that my wife and I were talking about earlier today, those who cling with almost a sense of abhorrent desperation to their younger punk rock roots? And notice I'm putting that in quotation marks because it's such a sickening thought, because the whole idea of punk was it was supposed to be a rebellion thing for youth. It was a youth-oriented thing. If you're in your 40s, 50s, and 60s, you sound like, and if you're still wearing the clothes, look like an asshole.
Right. And that was the whole thing. If you were 40 at the time, you weren't supposed to get it. It wasn't for you. And that's fine. I mean, the shit that my kids listen to, they get it, and that's good enough. It isn't for me. They're not recording that stuff for me. They don't have me in mind. But, you know, the fact that there is a Dave Grohl out there and he's still doing something entertaining is fine. And on the subject of guitars, there was something, because anytime I think of Dave Grohl, he's so identified with that ES-335, that Pelham Blue 335 with the little diamond cuts instead of F-holes. It's the coolest thing in the world. But there was something that passed through my hands this week, and I buy and sell guitars like crazy anyway. But back in the late 50s and early 60s, there was a line of Epiphone hollow bodies, and one of them was called the Crestwood, and there were a couple of other ones that were all these real short, tiny little, fairly light, solid body guitars, and they were fantastic. They reissued them right after Epiphone moved to Japan in the early 70s. So from about 72 to 77 or 78, they did reissues on all of these. And I caught one at a pawn shop and bought it with the intent in mind to sell it. And I damn near talked myself out of it. Because if you are in the market and the vintage guitar thing is attractive to you at all, take a look for one of these things. You can probably pick one up for a couple of $100, and they're completely worth it. They have that classic mid-70s lo-fi. They don't sound like the surf guitars from the late 50s and early 60s. It's two humbuckers, so it's immediately got a little bit of mud to it, but they're so easy to play, and they feel great, and it's going to look like nobody else on stage is going to have one that looks like yours. Great guitar.
Except for the Epiphone Crestwood Deluxe for $4,499 with three pickups and a whammy bar.
Right. Now, you can do that.
That's a nice-looking guitar. It obviously reminds me of, what is it? The Wilshire?
Yes, right, exactly. It's in the same series as the Wilshire, yeah.
It's a soft double cutaway.
Right.
You know, the only two people I can ever think of that ever used those was Chris Stamey. Used one when he was in the DBs. And Kate Pearson used one on stage with the B-52s.
Oh, nice. Okay.
I can't think of anyone else who ever used that particular style. But that's a really nice looking, that's a weird looking, but a nice looking axe.
And that's the thing, is it's credible, and, you know, it's going to be enough for people to look at it and go, the hell is that thing?
Now, I'm a casino guy, so I stick with tradition, you know, give me my 66, you know, sunburst, as I call it, the revolver casino.
Yeah, you and me both. Yeah, that's what's sitting downstairs right now. Only, like I said, mine's the one with the single pickup, so, yeah.
Nobody, I think I asked Binky Phillips if he'd ever even seen one with the single pickup, and he's like, what?
Yeah, right.
I'm sure he's going to get in touch with you one of these days to find out more about it, because I think he's pretty much intrigued.
No problem. Yeah, I would love to have that conversation with him. So, yeah, just a little something for the guitar players, and it's one of those that if you check on Reverb or eBay or whatever, you'll probably find four or five of them out there for sale at any given time. They're worth the get. So if you're thinking about it, then pull the trigger on that one. Bunch of other stuff going on, and we've got to talk about what happened in Alabama this week, because
I don't know where to begin on that.
Well, let's start with 10,000 votes. Actually, it ended up being 20, but when they called it, there were 10,000 votes separating Doug Jones from Roy Moore. And of course, Doug Jones finally won the thing. Roy Moore still hasn't conceded, but one of these days he's going to have to, because Doug Jones is going to take that seat one way or the other. So the fact that it was still such a razor thin margin. I have heard nothing this week, but oh, it was such a deep red state and now they've got a blue senator. Yeah, by 20,000 votes out of 12 million that were cast.
It's still 6 million votes too many going in the wrong direction.
Exactly.
Now, you know, as we all know, I'm not a fan of the Democratic Party, and I'll get to that after we talk about this. But the fact that you have somebody like Roy Moore, just someone who's despicable, really, yeah, get down to it. The fact that he wants to hold a vaunted seat in this in the United States Senate, the federal government, once again plays down to our absolute lowest common denominator, just the absolute disgusting base of people that don't think about the implications of having someone like him in a seat of power. That's the part that always... and I don't care what party you're in, but this one just happens to be yet again another Republican.
Yep.
You know? So, you know, 6 million votes that swung his way, there are 6 million people who need to be fixed.
Right. And you look at the way that it all shook out, and there was a fairly hefty primary fight on the Republican side, but what did they do? They voted for the asshole. And this is the real problem. I mean, the obvious thing that people seized on was the allegations that, you know, he was diddling 14-year-olds when he was in his 30s. Okay, right, I get that. And that's unfortunately the kind of thing that the conspiracy theory fucks on the right side. Sit there and go, oh, it's all lies. They're making it up. Oh, you know, and he never admitted anything. So they can play that game with that. But what really needs to be focused on, I think, outside of that is the fact that he's just an asshole. He's such a horrible person. I mean, and he's incompetent, too. He wasn't just kicked off the bench twice because he did things wrong. Legally speaking, he did. But it was a system of incompetence and stupidity all along the way. His entire career has been built on failure, and still they voted for that asshole.
Well, his aging cheerleader wife, she's at the beach.
Oh, she must be so much fun at parties, I tell you.
John, let's talk about one of our favorite subjects. You know what that subject would be.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to a doctor, what do you go to? You go to a Jew.
Right, right.
I'll just say the word accountant.
Right.
If I need a lawyer, you're goddamn right.
My uncle, who is an attorney, his favorite joke is, do you know the definition of attorney? It's a Jewish boy who can't stand the sight of blood. So, but when...
Just remember what Hitler said, paraphrasing Shakespeare. Once he got done with all the Jews, he was going to get rid of all the lawyers.
Right, right. All the ones who were left.
Anyway.
Right.
But, yeah. Mrs. Moore. Oh, Mrs. Moore. What a peach. What a peach.
And now she has to go home, which is fine with me. But, yeah, I mean, the fact is that there are 6 million people who just publicly embarrass themselves, and they don't think they did. They don't get it. They don't understand why what they did was so wrong.
Here's my problem with the way it turned out. By the way, as far as, you know, Mrs. Moore is concerned, fuck you too, you cunt. You and your piece of shit husband. Now I've said that, and that. Now we move on from there. Now, on the flip side of this, it's so typical, though, of the Democrats doing what they always do. They start sucking each other's dicks after
right.
One victory.
Yep, you know, one victory by 20,000 votes over a pedophile.
But at the same time, they're also doing that whole, they're playing race politics. You know, it's like, well, the black vote saved us. Hey, guess what? How about the fact that people in Alabama, doesn't matter if they're white, black, pink, green, puce, you know, tutti frutti, I don't give a shit. Those people woke up and said, I need to fucking vote. This is not race politics, you dumb fucks.
Right.
And this is why, and here's my announcement, I made good on my threat. I've had my fill of the Democratic Party. And after, well, I'm 52 now. I got my first, you know, voting card when I was 18. For the first time, I am neither a, quote, card-carrying liberal or Democrat. I have now no party affiliation whatsoever.
Good for you.
I refuse to have a party affiliation until these fucking people grow up and get their shit together and you get rid of the Bernie Sanders people and the fucking Jill Stein people and the so-called Greens and communists who managed to infiltrate the Democratic Party. Clean up your fucking act. Focus on the necessary things like each winnable battle, not the 2020 campaign, when we're going into 2018. And then talk to me after you've won some serious positions and you've made some actual headway.
Well, yeah.
Then perhaps I'll contemplate rejoining the party. Yeah. Otherwise, go fuck yourselves, too.
You asked last week whether there was a danger in that whole idea of, you know, throwing the party a little bit too soon and whether the Democrats were sick of losing because they kept doing that. And the answer is no, because even today, just this morning, I happened to flip on CNN for a couple of minutes and there they were talking about how, oh, the Democrats now think they could pick up 40 seats or more in the House and that would retake the House and the Senate on the same day. Yeah, you know what? That's next November. And you got a hell of a lot of work to do between now and then. If all you can do is squeak by Roy Moore, you've got a shitload of work to do, and you better understand that, or all of your little pipe dreams of winning 40 seats in the House and being able to retake the Senate are going to fly right out the window, and you're going to stand there with your dick in your hand and a stupid look on your face the same way you did in November of 2016 when Donald Trump became president.
Well, the other thing is this, though. How about making sure you have viable, solid candidates?
Right. Exactly.
Trotting out pieces of shit after pieces of shit. You can't really tell who's the Democrat and who's the Republican because no matter what, these are all always shitty people over and over and over again. And I wouldn't want to vote for any of these motherfuckers. Not one. I would just assume, God help me, go with the Republican who may actually have a better track record and seem to entice the Democrat who doesn't like his own party's candidate.
Right. Yeah. So, and, you know, and all that's going to do is hand another possible legislative win to Donald Trump. Well, where right now, I mean, as we speak, who knows what's going to happen with tax reform? And honestly, to most of it's not going to make a hill of beans worth of difference. Aside from just adding another exponential number to the debt, it's not going to mean much to anybody except the ultra, ultra wealthy.
You know, once again, the left has painted the picture, because this is how the politics seem to go at this moment. Anything and everything that Trump says or does is going to be met with the raising of holy hell, hands to the sky, screaming at the top of one's lungs, over-dramatization.
Yep.
That's all there is to it. We've heard all of this stuff before from other presidents. We heard it from Obama. We've heard it from Clinton. We've heard it from the Bushes. We heard it from Reagan. We heard it from Ford, we've heard it from, you know, the suddenly sainted idiot Jimmy Carter. We heard it from me. I got to stick myself in here somewhere. You're absolutely correct. It doesn't mean a damn thing at the end of the day. But because it's Donald Trump, everything's going to get magnified and ramped up to fever pitch panic level.
Right. And speaking of fever pitch panic level, that's exactly where they are in the White House right now. And the clock seems to be ticking even on Robert Mueller. Now all the debate is not if he's going to fire him, but when. And I don't know. I mean, honestly, I was so young when Watergate happened and when all that shit came to, I watched the hearings with my dad and I remember some of that, but I was a little kid. So I don't know. I mean, when it comes to Donald Trump's version of I guess it'll be the Friday Night Massacre this time around, what it's going to mean when you still have an overwhelming majority in the House and the Senate.
Well, now that you've brought up Watergate, I guess that's my cue. Let me tell you something about Watergate. I didn't do it. I've said it before. I didn't do it. It was John Dean. We were playing cover up and, you know, we had a pair of scissors and some tape and we were just, you know, making sound loops, you know, kind of like George Martin did for the Beatles. You know, and people thought we were covering up a conspiracy. The whole thing with Watergate, though, is that it was very clear-cut. There was also something back then that they didn't have called social media, so you couldn't get 50,000 permutations of a story and right, not know what the truth actually was. Once something broke, then you knew the dominoes were going to fall. All of a sudden, you'd see guys going, oh, shit, you know, and panic set in because, okay, it's coming.
Right.
That's all there was to it. It was very black and white. Because of the way things are right now, because you have somebody who's such a master manipulator with the media as Donald Trump, playing them like the collective violin that they are, he's going to play them right until the moment he attempts to fire Mueller. Now, there's got to be something to be said about the legality of him actually doing this. Because then it really does call into question, wait a minute, if you're, quote, innocent as you keep proclaiming you are, why would you stop him from continuing the investigation?
Right.
It's that simple. If you have nothing to hide, you open your doors and say, be my guest. Because obviously there is nothing here that you'll ever find or be able to nail me for. I've committed no crime.
Yeah, and he continues the same horse shit that he always has, where even this week when he was getting ready to get on the helicopter and stop to answer a couple of questions from the press, he said, everybody says it, everybody agrees there was no collusion. Nobody agrees that there was no collusion. Everybody is saying exactly the opposite of that. But he stands there and spouts that crap as though it means something. And what it shows me is that he is still in that mindset of believing that all he has to do is say something and it will then be true. And that's the thing, as you said, with the social media deal. If Nixon had lived through this time rather than the early 1970s, there is a chance he still would have been able to fill out his second term.
Either that, or the minute they broke into the Watergate Hotel, the shit would have gone down and heads would have rolled even faster.
Right.
It wouldn't have, of course it was due process, and it was the period where you had to investigate so that way that it was ironclad evidence against the president and all of his henchmen, which is why it took, over 2 years to really get things to happen, from 72 when the first rumblings began about the break-in to 73 when suddenly the trials were being put together. Till the indictments came, until Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Mitchell, yeah. John Dean were all called to testify. And then, of course, Agnew's resignation long before any of this stuff. And then finally, Nixon's resignation. It would have happened probably a lot. It was going to go either way. What you said is true, although I don't think he probably would have been – he wouldn't have been – as much of a media manipulator as Trump is, because Trump has been on TV for so many years as a game show host.
Right.
He thinks he's running a game show here.
Yeah, which goes back to, what happens in Alabama. Well, the press lays the win, Doug Jones's win in Alabama, at the feet of black women. And surely, they did show up in much larger numbers in the Alabama vote than they had in elections previous to this. So what does Donald Trump do? Turns around and fires the only black woman in the White House. Jesus. How could you get any more obvious?
Yeah, but that stupid bitch was always a fucking gadfly and an irritation on every level.
Agreed. But everybody there is. There's not a single savory person in the entirety of the White House, and there hasn't been.
No, it's true. They're all just despicable individuals, and it really is that horrible, corny, and laughable. Except this is not funny. Cliche about this being kind of like. The rounding up of every ugly criminal that they could find in Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, right.
In order to become the posse. Every nightmarish human being on the planet is part of this cabal, or whatever the hell you want to call it.
But do they have any Methodists?
Well, I know they have the Jew.
Yeah, exactly, at least one. Because everybody has to have one.
Well, actually, they got two, since, even though I don't
Mnuchin, right?
No, not that. Is that little weasel a Jew?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, fuck. No, not him, or that knock-kneed Scottish pillock of a wife of his. No, Jared Squeeze. What's her face?
Ivanka.
Aryan-looking Ivanka. But, at the same time, there is diversity in that cabinet, because they've got retards. They've got, apart from Donald himself, they've got Donald Jr. and Eric.
Right.
Talk about two dropped chromosomes right there.
Ben Carson.
Mongoloid.
Yeah.
Oh, Rick Perry, the embodiment of inbreeding.
Yeah, right. Oh, what a doofus. I mean, jeez, yeah. So that's the situation in Washington, D.C. at the moment. And it's funny because you had lined out something else to talk about today, going into the sports world, because here we are. We're getting into the end of the football season. We got three games left to play. And things are going a little squirrely, as they always do at the end, because, you know, guys get hurt. As a matter of fact, again, as we speak right now, the New England Patriots are playing the Pittsburgh Steelers in a game that has huge playoff implications about home field advantage and the AFC East and all of that. So, and Antonio Brown, star receiver for the Steelers, just went down with an injury, so he's being evaluated right now. That could be a big deal. And who knows? I mean, you know, the Bills just won. They beat Miami, so I'm a happy guy. The Jets, unfortunately, were not able to pull off the same stunt play in New Orleans, but...
But they showed New Orleans their up on their weaknesses.
Yeah.
And quarterback can't pass properly, you've got a problem.
Exactly. So there really isn't. I mean, the idea of a powerhouse. I mean, Green Bay got the shit beat out of them today. So I mean, I don't know what's to come in the NFL, but this is what makes it fun to watch when you get into these games down the stretch. Still, you know, their baseball winter meetings have not yet commenced, but there's a lot of moving and shaking going on right there. And right now, the Florida Marlins are in the middle of another salary dump. You remember they did this right after they won the World Series, because they bought all of these players, and then immediately after the season, I mean, the champagne was barely dry on the locker room floor when they started cutting guys left and right.
You know, I remember in the 70s when Charlie Finley had done that with the Oakland A's.
Yep.
And but he had to do it by way of trades. You couldn't just dump the salaries. There were no free agents or buying out of contracts. But I remember he'd done a trade where I think it was like Vita Blue and Gene Tennis went to the Yankees, Joe Rudy and Sal Bando and Ken Holtzman went to Boston, and just all these, you know, blockbuster deals. And every single one of these trades were negated by Bowie Kuhn. So later on, and this was after the 1974 season, going into the 76 season. This was after 75, because that was after Catfish Hunter was one of the first free agents and chose to sign with the Yankees. There was a midseason purge by Finley, in which he traded, I think it was Ken Holtzman and Reggie Jackson to the Orioles. I think Joe Rudy went to the Angels. Vita Blue wound up going to the Giants, I think. But this was how they did it, because this was when free agency was about to begin in full.
Yeah.
Because right after this happened, after the 76 season, Reggie Jackson signed as a free agent with the Yankees. Ken Holtzman came to the Yankees, and so on and so on and so forth. Now, with this is now constant, and this is a problem. The Marlins definitely should be taking a test, because they seem to do it with frequency. They did it in 97, over the winter of 97 to the beginning of 98. They did it after they won the World Series in 2003. And now they've done it again, and they haven't won shit.
Right.
But here's the thing. First of all, everybody's jumping up and down, especially the people of New York who are Yankee fans. I wouldn't be jumping up and down just yet, because Giancarlo / Mike Stanton has never had a full injury-free season.
Mm-hmm.
So don't get too enthralled yet. You do this all the time, people.
Right.
I got two words for you. Danny Tartable.
Okay? Well, yeah. And as far as Miami's concerned, Miami is the same way about baseball as Los Angeles is about football. Even good times, even when they're winning, nobody cares, because what they figured was, okay, but you got a bunch of, if you look at the ethnic breakdown in Miami, and not even just the ethnic breakdown, but where people were from, you got a bunch of Dominicans, you got a bunch of Haitians, you got a bunch of Cubans, you got a bunch of Puerto Ricans, and you got a bunch of snowbirds who still follow the Cleveland Indians and the New York Yankees and the Mets and all of that. They don't care about the Marlins, and the guys who are immigrants care about their own national team. They want to know what the Cuban national team is doing or the Dominican national team. They don't care about the Miami Marlins. So they're never going to draw. And the few fans that they do have better get used to this kind of thing about being kicked in the teeth because management just doesn't care.
Well, if you've ever watched a Marlins-Mets game, you will always see orange and blue in the stands.
Right.
As the predominant colors. That's an embarrassment.
Yeah, because everybody there was born in New York.
Yeah, it's all Mets fans. And I'm sorry, but when you do this to a team, you're not going to have a fan base. If you're trying to move the team, then why did you go to the pains of building a stadium so that way you could keep the team there and you'd have a reason to play in good and bad weather because it's a retractable – it's an ugly stadium, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen it on TV, but it's real – that's garish. What Derek Jeter has done, because he's the new co-owner and the one who's been calling all the shots here, very simply is, while he's trying to, you know, make a splash and throw his weight around, he's just alienated whatever good feeling he might have had. And I don't know why people are saying he's working for the Yankees. I don't know if he gifted the Yankees by sending Stanton to them, because like I said, Stanton may be a golden egg. That's all it is. He may be and when that egg gets laid, it's going to be spoiled because he's only getting older and he's been injured every single year that he's been in the league, period.
Right.
Yeah, he'll hit home runs for you. Big deal. He'll also strike out a hell of a lot, but he gets hurt really, really quickly. The guy is brittle. Having said that, you know, there was an interesting trade yesterday with the Dodgers and the Braves in which the Braves traded Sean Kemp, who was originally with the Dodgers and you know, became a star with them, for a five-player package, including all over-the-hill players, by the way, Adrian Gonzalez, Scott Kazmir, Brandon McCarthy. Obviously, these are two teams looking to make a salary dump, but at the same time, before he even, you know, the ink was dry, the Braves tendered Gonzalez designated for assignment. And the likeliness of Kemp will be the same thing when he gets, quote, back to the Dodgers. I mean, baseball is not a economically sound or particularly wise sport. I think they're probably the stupidest of all the sports when it comes to contracts and how salary structures should be. And I'll tell you what, if it's one thing that always makes me uncomfortable now with baseball, that I can't get into it like I did with the verve that I had as a kid, is this kind of nonsense.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, because it's all we care about is what happens on the field, and that seems to be the least of the worries of the people who are doing the moving and shaking right now. So we'll find out what the backlash is in Miami, if there is any, if anybody can garner any support or any ability to care whatsoever to go after Jeter and the moves that he's making here. So it should make for some interesting winter meetings. But that said, the other big news of this week has been entertainment news because, well, Star Wars opened. The Last Jedi has been open now for, well, officially it opened midnight Thursday into Friday, and everybody went nuts, and everybody put on all their costumes and went to the movie theaters to watch this thing. I have not seen it yet. Have you?
I have not, but I know exactly what happens in it, unfortunately.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to give any spoiler alerts, but I will say this much. It is so predictable that every asshole on the planet is going to go and say, oh, they did it in a Star Wars story. What the fuck is wrong with you people? Oh, that's a rhetorical question. I mean, you know, people act about movies the same way they act about politicians.
Yeah.
You know? Except it's worse. This is fantasy. This is a movie. I'm sorry. Luke Skywalker, as much as it pains me to say it, doesn't really exist. Han Solowitz doesn't really exist.
Solowitz.
Tell me he wasn't even more Jewy than he could have possibly have been than in the Force Awakens.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he just really was in just such a – you know what? It's like, oh, they got me off the beach at Tatooine for this. I mean, for Christ's sakes. You know, obviously Princess Leia is always going to be jappy. You know, they don't exist. It's, you know, Chewbacca, there is no such thing as Wookiees, people.
Right.
I know it kills you to hear that, and you're probably going to stick your fingers in your ears and go, la, 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 I can't hear you. It's a fucking movie, okay? If you don't like it, you don't like it. C'est la vie. You don't like your step and you walk out.
Yeah, and there's no shame in that. And that's the thing, is that I love the fact that there are people who are that into it. I think it's fine. You know, if you want to be a comic book geek and go to the comic cons and dress up and do cosplay or whatever, fine, do that. If it makes you happy, go with my blessing. But when it becomes, when the thing itself becomes of ultimate importance, when really it isn't, that's when it becomes a problem. And people start, oh, I'm never going to go see another one of these movies again. And it's like, oh, just grow up. The superhero movies, as many of them as there have been over the past decade, and I still am waiting for us to hit a saturation point with these things, but they're fairly cheap to produce, and they make incredible bank worldwide, which is why the stories are all so shitty, by the way, because they don't care about what these things do in the U.S. market. There's a built-in market for superhero movies, right, and whether they make a good one or a bad one really doesn't make any difference, because where it's going to make its money is in India and in China and in a bunch of places where they don't even bother to do subtitles. It doesn't matter what the people are saying. It matters if it's pretty and shit blows up real good. So it's fine, but I never go to any of those movies expecting to see anything. Where with Star Wars, if they make a lousy one, I mean, they made three lousy ones in a row starting in 1999. So,
hang on one second. There's only one trilogy.
That's right. There's only one Return, and it ain't of the King, it's of the Jedi.
It's of the Jedi.
Yeah,
whipping out your preciouses.
Oh, man. If you start talking about Samwise bricking in Frodo's mouth, I'm out of here. So, that may be the most disgusting and yet most hilarious line I've ever seen in any movie ever. When Randall said that, my jaw dropped.
Because
anyway.
He dropped it so easily.
Oh, yeah.
There was no... This movie was his tour de force, matter how you slice it.
Without doubt. You know? Clerks 2 was just something to...
Which is why I actually like it better than the first one.
Yeah, you and me both, we have that in common. But yeah, with the over-importance that people imbue with things like this, that's where it starts to just get a little bit too much for me, and I want to just walk out and go, you know what, leave me alone. Don't even involve me in this anymore. I'll see the thing when it comes on streaming.
Right, I mean, I'm going to wait until probably Christmas Day itself to go to the theater, because you figure if you go early enough, it might be parents and kids,
yep,
for an early show, and there's no Catholics, no Christians around on Christmas Day, so it's just, you know, obviously the Jews, so, you know, unless it's, of course, black folks, but then we'll never hear the fucking movie.
Wow! Oh...
That was just staring. One of us had to do it.
Yeah, well, the good thing is that the movie theater that we go to most often, it's a little bit of a drive from here, but it's the really nice theater. There's a TGI Fridays across the parking lot, and I normally wouldn't think of that as a good thing, but it is open on Christmas Day, so we can do lunch and movies.
That's helpful. That is very helpful.
Doesn't suck. Now, on that, the entertainment front, though, the thing that you've been watching, and I still have yet to get involved in this show, but the latest season finale of The Walking Dead just happened, so...
Yeah. It was, you know, this season started out so strong. Remember, we talked about it.
Yep.
It came out filled with action, and you know, it started to go into that midway slump. And it doesn't matter if a series is... At this rate, 13 episodes or 9 episodes, every series seems to go through these kinds of troughs.
Yeah.
But it started to pick up in the last 2 episodes, but this particular episode was poignant in that it sets up the opener of the season that begins in February. And, you know, there's no spoiler alert here. Everybody knows what happened. One of the characters that has been on the show, one of the two final characters from the very beginning of the show, the son of the main character, the notorious kid known as Carl Grimes, after being shot in the stomach as a little tiny kid, after having to shoot his mother after she turned into a haint, you know, after getting his eyes shot out, he got bit by a walker. He's dying. And he's going to die in the first episode. So, of course, they're going to have him on Talking Dead on that first episode night. But that was so upsetting to everybody because they kept building it up the week before saying, you're not going to want to miss what happens in this episode. It is going to be shocking. They're going to be You know, there's going to be reverberation about this for miles and miles and miles, and people freaked out when they saw it. I mean, really, you want to talk about people losing their shit over fictional characters.
Right.
Fictional characters. Am I getting through to you?
Yeah. Yeah.
He tweeted. He's fine. He wasn't really bitten by his zombies. Right. Don't really exist.
That kid is still alive.
Actually, I take that back. Zombies do exist. You go into the ferry terminal in the morning, and every mongoloid that's getting on the ferry is the Walking Dead because they've all got the cell phones in front of them, and they all shuffle like this.
And they all make that same noise, too.
Yeah, because they're all fucking babbling retards.
Oh, one of these days I'm going to have to spend a week in New York again. So,
just a terminal. That's what it is. It's a terminal.
Yep.
That's such a good way to phrase it. You thought Auschwitz was bad? Cool boy. All you were waiting for was a shower and it was over.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, you got to get on the fucking boat with these numb nuts, and then you got to be surrounded by the fucking Jesus freaks.
Oh, fun.
I know that we have freedom of religion and freedom of speech, but I also have the freedom of not being irritated by some dumb cunt screaming at the top of her lungs the wrong phrases from the fucking Bible.
Can I ask a silly question?
There are no silly questions, John.
What happened to the Hare Krishnas?
Well, you're looking at one. But that's beside the point.
No, seriously, where did they go?
You know, it's funny, as I notice that I show up my Krishna tattoo.
Nice.
I have actually seen a couple recently, but I don't think that they were trying to, what's the word I'm looking for? Not entice, corral? I don't think they were trying to just consciously whip up any kind of interest, like, you know, the proselytizers or the, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses or,
right.
Or, you know, any of those asswipes that have a table set up, you know, looking for donations. I think they were just kind of out walking around and thumping the drum and just chanting and singing and enjoying themselves on the street.
I haven't seen a Krishna in 15 years.
Well, the last time I saw a Krishna in the subway, it got me started in my interest in the Krishna consciousness movement, so, which is something I usually am very, very hesitant to talk about, because that's when people start to raise their eyebrows, like, wait a minute, what, are you being serious? Are you being sarcastic? And the thing is, I could not be more serious. I mean, I've been involved in Krishna consciousness for 30 years. But the thing is, I never had that inclination to, you know, shave my head or, well, except in the summertime now, obviously.
Yeah.
But back then, you know, shave my head and wear the prescription orange robes and give up everything that I have and give whatever little money I had to them. Or, hell, at the time, you know, I wouldn't even conceive of the notion of, you know, quitting smoking or stop drinking coffee, you know, or stop eating things that had onions or garlic in them, you know?
Yeah, right.
It was the philosophy and the teachings and the literature and just the teachings and the tenets of what the philosophy behind Krishna consciousness really is / was and will forever remain. So I think they all pretty much realize that they don't want to be lumped in as a cult because people tend to look down on them as a cult. So they keep to themselves now.
Yeah. Okay. You know? Yeah. Because I mean. With the exception, and I know exactly what you're talking about, because I've had friends over the years who took probably, I don't know, a year or more to tell me that they were Mormons, because they just didn't want to hear it, you know? And it was like, listen, I'm not going to give you any shit over your religion. Every religion except Scientology, and I don't consider Scientology a religion, so it immediately disqualifies itself, but every religion is full of good ideas. What people do with those good ideas is another matter entirely. But if you truly give yourself to a reading of Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, Krishna consciousness, whatever it is, and you don't find a single valuable thing in it, then you're either lying to yourself or you didn't do enough work.
Or you're just that, unfortunately, spiritually void.
Yeah, right, exactly, right.
There are a lot of people out there, I will tell you right now, who just have no clue. And it's those people that they do follow a certain pattern in terms of their, quote, humanity. There is a definite arm's length distance. You know, there is a definite coldness there that's so impenetrable. You know, when they go into, especially those who claim that they're atheists.
Yeah.
Because A, atheism is a belief system.
Sure.
There's no way around that. Two, I would say 99.99% of every atheist I've ever met is really an unpleasant, nasty, surly asshole. And subsequently, I would not have that kind of person in my life as a quote-unquote friend. You know, I don't care if you're the most devout religious Catholic on the planet and you go to mass first thing in the morning and at noon and at night or whatever. If it gives you spiritual guidance, comfort, a solid foundation, and our relationship is good and you're not proselytizing at me, then more power to you and God bless.
Exactly. You know, it's funny you should say that too, because I had a very good friend of mine, and this is one of the ones I was talking about, who for years and years, and we've known each other for 20 years or more, and I always knew of him as a Christian, but I didn't know what brand of Christian he was. And it wasn't until he gave it up and became a Latter-day atheist that he told me that he had been a Mormon. And, you know, and he said, now I don't see it. I don't see anything out there. I don't, you know, he said, I'm still as spiritual as I ever was, but I just don't see anything bigger than us out there controlling all of this. And, you know, and it was because of the break with the Latter-day Saints that he was able to finally do that and say, look, I can't live that life anymore, and I can't pretend to believe in something I don't anymore. But he's still one of the best people that I know. But then again, he's not trying to convince anybody they're wrong either.
Right. And what you said that he had said says everything. I'm just as spiritual now.
Right.
Spirituality comes in many different forms, shapes, flavors, and guises. And, you know, there are people out there who, of course, are just on the shallow end of that spirituality pool. Look, I dated a woman who, and she could not have been more serious in the conversation when she said, you know, even though I was born Catholic, almost every one of my friends are all Jewish. My daughter's best friends are all Jewish. Now that I'm with you, you know, you're Jewish. Maybe I should convert, finally. You know, I've always felt spiritually Jewish. And I was going to say, well, you know, that's fine, but you might want to look into more of it just because the people that surround you, that doesn't mean anything, you know. My parents were of a mixed marriage. My father never converted to Judaism. My mother never converted to Catholicism.
Right.
But the point was is that, you know, you need to be able to feel it, you know. But when she said that, you know, then she, because that's when she got into the whole conversation. And she said, but, you know, for a long time I was really into the Wiccan thing. And then I was like, oh, boy, here we go.
Oh, you're one of those. Yeah, right.
Right. We've always got to be picking from the spiritualistic smorgasbord. It doesn't work that way. You know, it's like the Beastie Boys. They were all little rich Jews from New York, but they were all into Buddhism. Oh, please.
Right.
You know, I don't buy that. Like I just said when we started this angle of the conversation, this is the first time that I've ever spoken publicly / on air with you about Krishna consciousness and the depth of my involvement and my belief in it, because that's also a very personal thing.
Sure.
You and I happen to be friends, so we can talk about anything. So I will share that, and this is our show, so I can share that. And I also feel comfortable, and it's also 30 years of a very solid grounding that Krishna consciousness has given to me. As a matter of fact, the person, one of the people that I love and care about most in this world has made, without any kind of prompting from me, because I don't even think she knew about this, said to me that she had recently been reading up on Krishna consciousness, and it completely floored me.
Yeah.
And in a wonderful way, and she was saying how interested she was, and she was starting in, and because she lives in Brooklyn, that's where the original Krishna consciousness temple had opened, which is still there. And she was thinking of going just to check it out and see, and would I be interested in coming with her? And I said, I think we need to have an actual conversation about this in greater depth. So when I see you, we'll talk about it. And what I did was I ordered for her copies of the books that I've held very near and dear, that are part of those books that helped shape and you know, give me the foundation that I needed to make my steps forward into the whole Krishna consciousness movement. And when I saw her on Friday for lunch, I said, for you know, you've seen the tattoo that's on my leg. It's Krishna on the lotus. She's like, yeah, I always thought that was amazing that you did that. And I said, that's because I've been involved in Krishna consciousness for 30 years and completely had no idea. So I handed her the books. I said, these were the books that got me started. So maybe these will help you give you a better, you know, that's all I can say is just read them and see what it does for you. You know, that to me says a lot more. And it's not because it was me saying it to her and because we're close. It's because when you feel a spiritual connection to something and someone else completely independent of you has that kind of interest and or desire, then I think it makes it even more valuable because now you're on the same spiritual plane.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, look, with the exception of one person ever in my entire life, I will decry no one who wants to convert and become a born-again Christian. If you do it for the right reasons. You know, if you want, I've had people who I've known, people who were Christian, who have converted to Judaism. I've had friends and relatives who were born Jewish, but had that moment of, and I know it's going to sound cheesy, but I'll use it anyway, awareness and enlightenment, and go through the process of becoming born again Jews, where they go into the whole, not Hasidic, but they become Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're fucking Shabbos.
That always reminds me of Demi Moore's character in that in the Woody Allen movie where she starts referring to their child as Hillel, even though his name is Hilliard. You know, it's like, yeah, how far do you really need to take this after you convert?
Right. I mean, it always depends on what you need. You know, that's the point. Is it's what you need.
Yep.
If there's nothing there and you don't find anything, there's nothing to be ashamed of. Just don't go around saying you're an atheist. If you don't believe, it's one thing, but doing the whole pounding of the table that atheists tend to do.
Right.
That's another story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It has to come to you organically and naturally.
I am one of those people who is just perfectly happy not knowing. I'm cool. I'm good. You know, I don't need anything. I'm not on a search. I'm not on a journey. I'm just fine. So with that, it's...
Wait, I got one question. What happened after you saw Arnie Sultan and you consulted the Ouija board?
Well, I decided at that point that I was going to become a member of the Church of Latter-day Pagans, Pharisees, and Money Changers. So I think from there on out, I'm going to be fine.
You know, money changers, huh? In other words, Jew.
Exactly. Jewy? Yeah, I sure did. So as we head into the In Our Head segment, I have been waiting for this because I don't want this to come off like a brag, but anybody who has ever been in a band is going to know exactly what I'm talking about when we start the In Our Head segment, because I want to talk to you about the Reset songs. And here's what I mean by that. I a couple of weeks ago, a guy that I had been playing guitars with for a few months, and we had been talking about putting a couple of different things together, said, hey, why don't you come over on Thursday this week, because my Beatles band is getting together, and, you know, we could use you. And I thought, okay, I can do that. So I grabbed my 12-string electric, and I headed over there. And we had a great time. And we rolled through a bunch of the standard songs in the Beatles catalog and a couple of the non-standard songs in the Beatles catalog, and they sounded more than adequate. And then this time, when I went back this past Thursday, you know, again, it was fine, and I thought, you know, I wish I could contribute a little more in terms of playing and singing, but a lot of that stuff is so intricate that I really need to concentrate on what I'm doing on the guitar. And toward the end, got to be about 9 o'clock, and it was like last song. And so we decided to skew away from the Beatles catalog, and I just started, I don't even know why, just started strumming the opening chords to You Can't Always Get What You Want. And for the next 5 minutes, we sounded better than we had in anything we had done for those previous 2 weeks. And it seems like, and I've had this happen in bands before, where there's always that one thing where if you're having a lousy practice and it's all gone to hell and nobody's getting anything done and you just feel like crap, there's that one song that you can play that will bring it all back, that you will always be able to bang out and at least have a good time doing. So what's yours? What's the song that you always went back to and said, you know what, let's just rip through this one and then we'll all be fine?
There were a lot of those, actually, and I'll go right back to the beginning with 2 Minutes Hate. And there's a story here because it was quite accidental, and it wasn't the exact members of the band. We would try and rehearse, and there are times that things would go, as you said, not right.
Yep.
People are tired, people are in bad moods, whatever. We found our reset when we were trying to rehearse on a Saturday, which was rare for us. And our bass player, Mark, his brother Carl, because we would rehearse at Mark's house, was kind enough to pick us up. He became our chauffeur and photographer and roadie. And when need be, we would have him, this is all later on down the road, have him sing backup vocals. Of course, Carl would later become the bass player for the Punchline, and Mark would move over to guitar. But we were having a shitty Saturday, and, you know, my guitar was on the fritz, so I was borrowing one of their older brother Frankie's guitars, and our guitarist Joel didn't bother to bring his guitar, so he was using Frankie's favorite Telecaster. And, you know, while it was okay for me to use one of Frankie's guitars, Frankie was pissed off at Joel, saying, you know, you need that guitar to stave off a beating, because I don't want you playing my fucking telly. I mean, it was just like this whole comedy of errors, and everything was going wrong. And then Carl walked in, and for whatever reason, I had brought with me my 12-string acoustic, which I had just gotten a few months before. It was a 12-string Guild Madeira. That was their cheapo line. But Carl saw it, and his eyes lit up, and he just was like, ooh. And he just starts gently strumming it. And as he's strumming it, he starts to strum an E to, I think it was in a C sharp ninth.
Okay.
To an E back to a D or whatever the hell it was. And he's humming the melody, and just instinctively, I started singing. There were bells on a hill, but I never heard them ringing. And we were trying not to laugh because I was McCartneying it.
Yeah.
But then I picked up his acoustic six string, and when it got to the guitar solo, just again, intuitively speaking, I ripped right through George Harrison's notes, you know. And we were in hysterics by the end, and that set everybody into a really good mood.
Yeah.
So we all went downstairs, trooped down, and did the rehearsal. So we got through. So that was reset number one. A few weeks later, it was the band in the car, Carl driving, and we were going to go do a photo shoot, but it was really hot, and we were starting to feel really irritated. If I Fell came on the radio, and Carl started singing, you know, the If I Fell in Love with You, the minute it kicks in, I started singing the McCartney harmony.
Right.
And we just looked at each other, and they're watching it because I was sitting in the front. So Mark, Joel, and Vinny are sitting in the back, and they're all looking like, holy shit, they're singing the harmonies, because those guys couldn't sing. So I was singing by myself in the band.
Yeah.
Carl and I are locked doing this, and we're in hysterics afterwards, and we wound up doing a great photo shoot. So subsequently, those two songs always became resets for whenever shit would go bad. Carl and I started playing together. What we would do is we called it the Breakfast Club at first. We'd get together on Tuesdays. We'd get up. We'd go out to usually Perkins Cake and Steak, have a big old breakfast, go out and roll at least 2 to 3 games, and then go back to their house because we both had Tuesdays off from school because, yeah, you know, we were in college. And we go down to the basement and we play our acoustic guitars, and we would always do Beatles, Everly Brothers, The Hollies, Simon and Garfunkel, whatever had harmonies, or songs that really work, you know, a summer song, World Without Love. One day I brought in, by way of the Stones actually, I brought in You Better Move On.
You asked me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me I'm not the man she's worthy of. But who are you to tell her who to love? That's up to her. Yes, and the Lord above. You better move on.
He didn't even know the song. But that became like our automatic reset.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because, you know, we would usually start off with something like, you know, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away or something like that. And, you know, and then we got asked to do, the girl I was seeing at the time asked me if I would do Le Café, which was the talent show at Pace University. And I thought, we'll do a couple of Everly Brothers songs because it's two-part harmonies. And, you know, who doesn't know the Everly Brothers, right?
Yeah.
So we went and we did Wake Up Little Susie and All I Have to Do is Dream. And we wound up winning it, shockingly enough, which meant our asses got laid that night.
Attaboy.
You know, you got to do it. You know, you got to. You know, it's your moment of glory. But afterwards, you know, people were asking us to play more stuff. And we were both kind of like paralyzed for it because we were still reveling in the moment that we had just won this thing. And we'd been drinking afterwards to celebrate. We'll play. And just automatic reset. Ding, 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 ding. And we started doing You Better Move On. And people loved that. So when we went out and played live, we would do that song because it was going to be a table setter, really. So that was always the automatic reset. Now, later on in the punchline, when things went really bad, which was very frequent, just because we could never get along, there were three songs that would always put everybody back, basically get everybody back in line if we hadn't, you know, tried to do them, because they were also staples of the set. The first one was I Feel Free, because it was one of the few Cream songs that all of us could stand.
Yeah, great tune.
An unhealthy obsession with Cream, but that is such a great song that, and we would all do it, you know? It would start off with, you know, Chris doing the, right. Chris would do the, I feel free. And then I would do the, and then Chris and I would sing the vocals. He would sing the Jack Bruce part, and I would sing the Eric Clapton harmony over it. But then I would sing that middle, I could walk down the street, there's no one there, yeah, blah, 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 part. And we did it so well and so powerfully that, you know, if we did that song first as a rehearsal number, it put a good precedent ahead. But if we didn't do it right away and things started going sideways, we'd always fall back on that one. Or Pleasant Valley Sunday, which every time I think about our version of that, even to this day, I still get chills because it was always note perfect.
Yeah.
Always. And it was so powerful because those vocals between Carl and I, when it was us, he would sing the lead vocal and I would sing the Nesmith harmony when that came in the second verse.
Mm-hmm.
But then that whole, you know, creature comfort goals, they only numb my soul, you know, I need a change of scenery. I would sing the Mickey Dolenz parts from there on out because I could naturally do that with my voice, not in falsetto. So that, you know, bop, 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 part where he goes, bah!
Right, right.
That comes out naturally. And we would do it in just such an ungodly way. I thought, wow, we are really very good. Especially at the end with the whole, you know, another Pleasant Valley Sunday, and I would sing the really high falsetto part deliberately. That always put us in a good mood. And if I was in a shitty mood, it was always my thing. My fallback number was one that we pulled out from the 2 minutes heydays after Joel had left the band and we were down to a three piece. And that was always South Central Rain. Was always my fallback, just to, you know, it was my head clearer.
The trees were bent, the conversation.
So that was always there. You know, that's why that's a song that I've always said, no matter what gig I've played, that song's always been there somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, in gig. And I would do it even tomorrow if I was to ever play. Because I also just love the song that much, whether it was solo acoustic or, you know, there are some songs that and of course now, if I ever, you know, played again, I gotta do the Bull Rushes. The Bull Rushes is, you know, I jokingly said to Richard Barone one day, God, that song is more mine than it is yours at this stage, you know? He goes, well, I've heard you do it, you know, I know, you know, how well you do it, so. And it's always part of the Wildflowers, which was the first single the Punchline put out, so you know, one segues into the other. So it always goes as a two-piece, and it works seamlessly.
Yeah.
Those are my fallback numbers all the time.
That's cool.
They'll never change, I don't think.
Right, and there's just something about them. If you want to know what that does, all you have to do is watch that scene, that fantastic scene, the scene that made the movie in Almost Famous, the Hold Me Closer, Tiny Dancer scene, and what it does to them when they all go through that song, and then you'll know what that feels like. One of the first bands I was ever in, and again, it was because we could pull it off and make it sound I'm, you know, again, not bragging, but it just sounded like the record every time we did it. Was No Matter What by Badfinger. And it's so much fun. And that's the other thing is that there are songs, and this is hard to explain to a non-musician, that are just fun to play. It feels right. Your fingers just drop into it, you know? And when you get that rolling and everybody's feeling it, there's no high like that.
You know what? One of those. You just brought up an interesting angle. One of the ones that just your fingers just drop into it,
yeah.
And it's fun to play. She's a Woman and I Feel Fine. Basically, you're doing both sides of a single right there.
Right. But,
you know, we'd be standing around. I remember when I first brought my Epiphone to a rehearsal for the Punchline, and they're all like, "Oh, holy shit!"
Yeah. You know?
And they're all just waiting for me to say something, and I didn't say a word. I just stood there, and I went, you know. And they're all falling about laughing.
Right.
Because it just automatically, and it led them to doing. But at the same time, when I had the Rickenbacker, and I brought that in, we automatically kicked right into Start, because they knew that was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know? Or Taxman, or both, you know, because we had the audacity to do that. But there are the, you know, the reset songs and the ones you just fall into automatically, and you just can't help it.
Yeah.
You can't. I mean, I remember Mark being a smartass. He had borrowed somebody's Flying V, and the minute he walked in with the Flying V, I knew what he was going to try and make us do. But it didn't work because, A, you only need one guitar to do it, and B, he didn't get it right. Whereas he wanted us to try and do Makes No Sense at All.
Yeah.
That ain't Husker Du. It ain't going to happen. You know? That's a completely different realm.
I hear you, man. Well, listen, I knew there would be great answers there. Rob Ross, that's going to just about do it for you and me this time around, but I know we've got some new music, and in fact, I've got some new music to lay on you for our next get-together on number 45. And with any luck, I will have been able to use my movie pass to go catch the new Star Wars film, so we can do a little more talking about that, and who knows what else will come up. But, you know, it's getting in toward the end of the year, so I know we've got a lot of review to get to as well.
This is very true, and it's funny because this year, thankfully, I mean, for the cruelties that this year has brought upon all of us, and I mean the world over, thankfully it's over in a couple of weeks. So we have 2018 to look forward to, and it looks like it's at least a promising year. So there's always hope.
Yeah, and right now with 9:29 left to go in the fourth quarter, Pittsburgh's up 24-16 over the Patriots. So I'm even happier.
There's always hope.
Have yourself a good week, Rob.
You too, brother. I'll see you later.